Welcome to Ahead of the Game, a podcast brought to you by the Digital Marketing Institute. I'm your host, Will Francis, and in this episode, I'll be talking to Rand Fishkin all about his digital marketing and his business journey, how and why he's built the well-loved tools we know him for, and generally, I'm just going to mine one of the most respected brains in our industry. Hope that's okay, Rand. Rand is co-founder and CEO of two companies, SparkToro, the audience research software, and Snackbar Studio, an indie game developer currently working on their first title. He's dedicated his professional life to helping people do better marketing through his various writing, videos, speaking, and his book, Lost and Founder. When Rand's not working, he's usually cooking a fancy meal for the love of his life, author Geraldine de Ruyter. Rand, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you.
Yeah, great to be here, Will. And congratulations on pronouncing Geraldine's last name correctly. That is a feather in your cap.
I've noticed we get that with American guests, actually. It's not the first time someone's gone, oh my God, you pronounced it right, but we're surrounded by European names here, so I have an unfair advantage. Rand, it's great to have you. I'd love to just get a sense from you, just to sort of zoom out, set the scene. You're a veteran of the internet. You've been in, you're pretty long in the tooth, a bit like myself. You've seen the various stages of evolution of it, of that. Where do you think we are? How would you characterize the era that we seem to be heading into? Because it seems like SEO is entering something new, search is entering something new. Social media seems to be going into a new era that's obviously very algorithmically and video led. And then there's the whole AI thing around that. The relationship between brands and the consumer also seems to be heading into something new again, I think, that's more casual and human, even more so than what social media did. So what do you see as being the kind of atmosphere that we're all breathing, the environment that we're in these days?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting is we're in a, I think we have closed the gap from early stage to maturing to mature. The internet is a mature platform. The digital marketing opportunities that exist today, which there are plenty of them, but they are no longer early mover opportunities. So whereas, you know, when I started doing SEO in 2001, 2003, you know, very few people were doing it. And so you didn't have to be very good at it to make a huge impact for a business or a website. Even being digitally savvy and doing any kind of digital marketing at that era, you know, you were benefiting from that early adopter stage. The same was true with social media channels, you know, starting with, well, MySpace and then Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and Reddit and YouTube and all of them. You know, as each of those platforms grew and became dominant in their respective fields, right? LinkedIn in B2B, YouTube in video, Reddit in forum and discussions, Twitter in text, although now, you know, that's sort of dead, and Threads looks like it'll probably be the winner in that space. But again, you know, no first mover advantage the way there used to be, no early adopter benefit. We're just mature in all these channels. That's true for in all of the advertising sectors as well. It's true in PR. It's true in media. There's virtually no sector, especially after COVID, there's virtually no sector, large or small, of the economy almost anywhere on the planet that doesn't have sophisticated digital marketing talent, website operators playing in those fields.
It's true that, isn't it? But, you know, they were more tumultuous times because I worked at MySpace and I saw from the inside that whole thing just implode in such a short space of time. And I wonder if that could even happen today, because even when you look at Twitter, what's happened over there, I think, if that had happened 10 or 15 years ago, you know, a buyout by an erratic billionaire, I think it would have happened much quickly, that just this overnight. Whereas actually it's not. I mean, it still has millions of users. So there's definitely, the concrete has set a bit, hasn't it, on the landscape. It's less fluid for sure than it used to be.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's, you know, it's tough to bring down an entire network. Twitter, to your point, right, is down maybe 20-25% in usage. But, you know, it has not had an implosion like a MySpace or even something like Tumblr, which technically still exists and still has millions of users, but is very much
quite niche
media today.
And what about the relationship between brands, companies, and their consumers? How is that changing today? Because, you know, you're obviously thinking about that a lot with an audience research tool that you're running, but also the customer base you're building around that. What are the sort of challenges, but the opportunities around that, the nature of that relationship today, do you think?
Well, so I hesitate to say that there is any description I could give you that would be accurate across multiple industries or multiple businesses.
Yeah, sure.
Different businesses, very frankly, have different relationships with their different customer groups. I think we're seeing massive amounts of diversity in the answer to that question. You know how, I don't know if you've heard this expression of what's popular with the kids these days, right? There's always some sort of generational aspect of what music is popular, what clothing in particular is really interesting as applied to people who are currently between the ages of 13 and 25. Because my understanding from the world of fashion is everything is currently in fashion. 60s is in fashion, 1970s in fashion, 2010s in fashion, weird futuristic stuff in fashion, wearing pajama bottoms with fancy tops in fashion, wearing mismatched clothing in fashion, wearing stylish suits in fashion. There's nothing that's out of fashion. And I think this is partially a result. I've seen analyses that it's partially a result of what COVID lockdowns did to trends and how sources of influence have diversified so massively, and people are getting algorithmically served their own interests in such a way that it reduces the power of gatekeepers and the power of singular influential sources, you know, big media sources on everyone. Right? We're no longer...
Because everybody lives within a tiny niche, and it's like this patchwork of a million niches rather than these mega trends that dominate culture.
Precisely. So if I were going to try and describe the, especially consumer trend relationships, I would say that is a good descriptor, that essentially we're in this, everyone's in their own bubble, hyper diverse, hyper specific, and nothing is quite wrong right now.
Yeah, it's true. But I think it's the same with music. I mean, for different reasons, but, you know, the effect of streaming, the fact that everyone has their own playlisting opportunities and can draw from the last 100 years of recorded music, you know, and ultimately the trends for the last 10, 15 years have kind of melted away those mega trends to some extent. So it's interesting.
Yeah, I think this is actually
areas of culture.
The weirdest thing that I saw in regards to music, I want to say this was a Spotify analysis, but it was basically an analysis of what do people listen to. And the only thing that's really true is that new music is not being adopted in the same way old music is. So people who are currently quite young, right? Kids, teenagers, early adulthood, are listening to a lot of music from the 1950s through to the 2010s. And they're listening to less music from the last 10 or 15 years than previous generations like them would have. That's surprising to me, but also interesting.
Oh, absolutely. You know, my son currently has that Simple Minds track, Everybody Wants to Rule the World, on his mind because it's being played a lot in some Roblox game he plays, I think, or something. And then that's infected other areas of kid culture and he thinks, he sees that as new. To him, that sounds new. It might as well be new. I think that's what's so fascinating about it, right?
Well, here's part of why that works, right? So in the marketing universe, one of the things that really helps something achieve some traction is familiarity, right? We're all biased by familiarity to a brand, a song, to clothing, to facial expressions, right? This is just how human beings operate physiologically, is that they trust those things more, they like those things more, they're more inspired to listen to them. And because of this, many creators use familiar items in their recordings, their creations, right? So if you and I are making let's say a TikTok video or a YouTube video or a mod for Minecraft, we are going to leverage some of that familiarity bias and call back to things that we know that at least some part of our audience will already know about. And by including that, it makes things that come from past ages more successful. Yeah. If you want to look at why Hollywood won't fund new intellectual property, right? Why they keep doubling down on, well, let's go find this crappy comic book from the 1970s and make that into another movie. Well, it's because familiarity bias is very strong and they can play the numbers.
Yeah, it's true. That same in video games. So many, I was just browsing the PlayStation store today. I'm like, oh my God, it's all reissues. Well, a lot of it's reissues. It's perpetual sequels of Tomb Raider and Need for Speed and Uncharted and another, version of this and that. So interesting, isn't it? Okay, well, just to seg into understanding the audience, what's going on inside their heads, that's really the purpose of SparkToro, which is what you've been working on for the last few years. I'm a user of it. I show people that product and I use it myself. It's really good. What's the aim of it? Just for our listeners' benefit, what is the aim of that product?
Well, our customers are actually, speaking of incredibly diverse, our customer use cases are very diverse. We have boards of trade and economic development who use SparkToro to help businesses in their country try and understand, American or British audiences and what they pay attention to, read, watch, listen to, so that they can go to market in those places. We have folks in the SEO field who use the new V2 of SparkToro just for keyword data, right? Because the keyword data in there is quite different from what you would find in a traditional SEO tool. And so they log in and export the keyword data and then put it in their favorite SEO tool of choice and do their analyses that way. We have folks in the PR field who use SparkToro almost exclusively to just find new PR opportunities. Like, oh, here's a blog, or here's a YouTube channel, or here's a podcast, here's a webinar series, here's someone with an email newsletter that's very popular with this particular audience, and that's who I want to reach, and so I'm going to help my client do that. Event organizers use it to try and figure out who should I invite to be the speakers at my event. Webinar hosts like yourself might use it to say, oh, who's very influential with, digital marketers in Canada? And then, you look at SparkToro's data about that and go, okay, I want to get that person onto our show. Let's invite them because we know that they reach a bunch of this audience. There's people who use it for persona building, people who use it for content marketing purposes, people use it for brand strategy, for making deals.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one of my favorites. I can't tell you the name of the show because I'm not allowed to reveal it, but there was a show that Netflix canceled. And this marketing team that works in Hollywood basically reached out to us, got a bunch of data inside SparkToro and used that data about who talked about the show online, searched for it, was into that show, used it to pitch it to one of the other streaming services and put the audience data in their pitch and won another season of the show with it, which I was so excited about.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah. I mean, that's a good explanation about how the product works, because you put in a keyword, a thing, a phrase, and as it leads you to say, it's, I want to know about people who are talking about, and you put in that, you fill that blank, and it shows you, like you say, their media diets, or what, YouTube channels, podcasts, subreddits, media outlets, but also some demographic stuff, what kind of hashtags they use in social, and this kind of sort of builds this picture, doesn't it? And so that you can understand that particular, like we've talked about, this patchwork of a billion niches that make up the internet, and you can zone in on those, each niche that talks about a specific thing or a general thing, because at different sizes. And that's what's interesting. But I'm sure I read somewhere that, and correct me if I'm wrong, your aim was around for the customers. That was actually quite expensive previously. It was hard and expensive.
It's so hard.
Bring it down to the sort of small business. Am I right about that as being the sort of your original idea?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So Casey and I talked to a healthy number of folks in a lot of these different marketing and marketing adjacent fields, right? So folks in PR, folks in content marketing, folks in brand research and brand strategy, all those kinds of things. And we asked them, like, hey, how do you currently solve this problem? If I were to say to you, okay, you are making a new software product for interior designers, and you want to reach interior designers in the United States, how do you go figure out what they pay attention to, watch, listen, read, subscribe to, follow online, if you don't already know? And the answer was basically, I Google around. Yeah. Now, they also would run surveys and interviews, which I think can be fine, but asking in a survey, tell me all the podcasts you subscribe to, is a terrible way to go about that. You're just not going to get, it's not that you won't get an honest answer, it's that you won't get a relevant answer. And the same is true for, tell me all the websites that you visit around interior design to learn about that stuff. And you'll probably get name drop the top two or three, which is okay. But what you really want is, I want 500 of the ones that are most read by interior designers, and show me which ones get relatively high engagement compared to their whatever social following, or compared to their audience size, because those are the hidden gems that I'm really interested in targeting. They probably have lower advertising rates. They might be willing to take a guest pitch, all that stuff. So we ask around. People did not have great answers to this. And the only solutions, the only software solutions, data solutions, were extremely expensive, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, which is, you know, no small agency, no small business can do that. So we wanted to do it for the whole internet. And yeah, that mission has been fun to follow.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, you came to that with the personal brand that you'd built. That didn't happen by accident. Just for listeners' clarity, you didn't accidentally become well known because you'd built Moz. You know, you did. You were very much put yourself at the service of that brand. You got out there. Sure. You did the conferences. You did videos and created content. So you used that as fuel for the brand. So what did you learn anyway about personal brand building as you were doing that? I'm curious.
I mean, a tremendous amount about what works and doesn't, which I'm going to say is very individual to different people. I don't think there's one way to build a personal brand. And I would also say it's not right for every entrepreneur or founder. It can have lots of negative drawbacks. Never mind the, whatever, online hate and threats and those kinds of things. But just from a brand positioning standpoint, I have found it to be incredibly challenging to make any sort of transition. Something that people for sure really like to do is pigeonhole other people in their mind. If you think about your friends and I say to you, hey, do you know anyone who's a plumber? And you might say, oh, yeah, my friend so-and-so. No, wait, maybe they left plumbing. Oh, my God, they left plumbing 25 years ago. Gosh, I just, I always think of them as a plumber.
Yeah.
Now imagine that on the internet, right, at scale with hundreds of thousands or millions of
people.
Yeah. So I'll give you an example. Even in my Moz years, so Moz for its first, I guess that would have been its first 5 years of existence. Maybe six, 2003 to 2009, Moz, the business, offered SEO consulting. At the end of, at the latter period, it was mostly software, 2007, 8, 9, it was mostly software. And in 2009, it cut off its consulting business entirely, did no consulting, only did software. But for a decade, more than a decade after that, in 2020, I got emails, even though I was no longer at Moz, I would get emails saying, hey, Rand, I'd love to work with you and do some SEO consulting at Moz. And I went, well, friend, I don't work there. And it hasn't done consulting in 11 years. So I'm happy to recommend some good folks who can. And they're like, oh my gosh, I'm so surprised. I heard great things about you from whatever, so-and-so at Zillow. You know, like, yeah, I worked with them in 2008. It's been a while though, but those kinds of things stick. And you can take advantage of that, right? By sticking with one thing your whole career and really building on it. But it can also
You have to lean into a thing to start with, don't you? You have to pick a thing and lean into it and lean really hard into it. But you got to commit to it. But then you're right, pivoting is not made easy for you. And I think, yeah, people of all stripes get that problem, don't they?
I mean, a lot of people still come to SparkToro every day assuming that it's an SEO tool, right? They just assume by default, well, Rand Fishkin, SEO, SparkToro, got to be an SEO tool. And, you know, SparkToro now, the new version, V2, does have some SEO features, right? It'll show you keyword data that people search for, which is kind of SEO related, right, to audience research.
Is that available, by the way, V2?
Yeah. So you can, if you have a paid account in SparkToro, there's a banner across the top that says you can try the beta of V2 anytime you like. You just click that banner, you'll be taken to V2, and you can click the banner again and go back to V1 if you want. But yeah, we've had several thousand people try V2 and gotten a lot of good thumbs up. So I'm very much hopeful that we can launch it. The frustrating part, Will, especially for you, V2 doesn't yet have UK data in it. And that's unfortunately, it's quite a challenge to add data by country. Yeah. So anyway, I'm talking to my co-founder.
So what, it's US or global?
US.
Yeah, that's all right.
V2 is US. V1 supports a bunch of different English speaking countries, including the UK, Ireland, New Zealand, Australia, all that. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, look, we'll have a play, and no doubt you'll roll that out for us outside the US at some point. I'll keep bugging you about it.
Hello, a quick reminder from me that if you're enjoying our podcast series, why not become a member of the DMI so that you can enjoy loads more content from webinars and case studies to toolkits and more real-life insights from the world of digital marketing. Head to digitalmarketinginstitute.com/aheadofthegame to sign up for free. Now back to the podcast.
I'm interested about how people use the tool. What is the importance of learning all that stuff about your audience? Why is that important as a marketer?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is the core of how you determine where and how you should do marketing, or as the VCs like to say, go to market. If you find, for example, that you are targeting an audience of people who really learn about things by subscribing to email newsletters, but you're putting all your effort into Instagram videos, that's a big disconnect, right? You know, if you, for example, I have a friend who works in a regenerative agricultural tech company. They take like these sensors, monitors, and shove them into the ground in literal farmers' fields. And then they measure, you know, soil type and density. And it has all this cool sort of artificial intelligence where it learns which things are growing and which plots faster. And when it rains, how, you know, what do you have to do? Really cool technology. Like, I think it's a super phenomenal, interesting company. But if you are trying to reach agricultural tech buyers for small and mid-sized farmers in the United States, I can promise you that Instagram videos or TikTok is not going to be, that's not how you're going to reach that audience, right? It's still very hard to reach them online in general, but it turns out there are a few websites, a few conferences and events, a few YouTube channels, a few podcasts that are very popular with these sort of, they're essentially farmers or owners of farmland, right? Agricultural technology optimizing folks. And that they have a variety of job titles and roles. But if you don't know that field very well already, it's just going to be ludicrously hard to craft a thoughtful, intelligent, successful marketing and advertising strategy. And my frustration is most people just throw money at Google and Facebook. Right? They're like, hey, we want to reach more folks. I'm just going to tell Google and Facebook what my thing is, and their system will figure it out for me.
Trust the algorithm.
Answer is yes. Yeah. I mean, it technically will, right? Technically, Facebook and Google will show your ad to some relevant audiences, and you can expect to reach them. But the first thing I'd say is advertising is a terrible first way to reach somebody. Just does not perform versus organic brand mentions or word of mouth or from a trusted resource, or I first heard about them from this email newsletter I follow. The second thing is those ads are so expensive. they are so relatively expensive compared to all the other things that you could do, right? Google's whole business model is, hey, Will, I noticed that you're making a dollar of margin. Can I have 99.99 cents of it, right, to reach your audience? That's how Google grows their business. And I think that kind of sucks. It's boring. It's expensive. It's not creative. It's not thoughtful. If you want to have a competitive advantage in marketing, I think you have to know who you're targeting and where you can reach them with the right message at the right time. That's how you get that advantage.
Yes, but it's about really knowing them. It's about getting in their heads, isn't it? And really understanding what resonates to them, what they care about. We've been talking about that for years, you know, this kind of customer centricity. But do you think companies are getting better at that?
Or are
they relying too much on the tools like you talk about?
Let's see. I think both things are true at once. Some companies have become really, really good at it. And they've gotten good at it through a variety of things, through buying data from various platforms, right? So Clickstream data has been available for a long time. That powers a lot of what we do at SparkToro. So this is essentially like a large anonymized panel of mobile and desktop devices. And they sort of like a Nielsen TV family, right? They send every URL that they visit back to the, you know, mothership, which aggregates them, anonymizes all the data, and then resells it, you know, in packaged form. Comscore has been doing this for years. Nielsen's been doing it for years. We buy data from a company called Datos. SimilarWeb's quite popular in the digital marketing universe that does this. I love that kind of data. I think it's phenomenal. It's also really expensive. Very, very expensive. And hard to manage and deal with. But my sense is like if we at SparkToro can sort of democratize access to not just clickstream data, but sort of audience understanding, more people will be able to invest in that. Because right now, the brands that are becoming more not just customer centric, but data driven in their customer marketing activities, those brands are ones that have a lot of money to spend and are going out and spending it.
How are you marketing SparkToro most successfully?
Okay. I'm proud to say I get no search traffic, which I know is very awkward. People are always like, well, what kind of SEO are you doing for SparkToro, right? Going back to our earlier conversation about personal brand.
Yeah. Big expectations on you.
Almost no search traffic. The only search traffic we get really is for our brand name. And so SparkToro is 99% three sources: word of mouth, which I love. Mm. It's kind of my favorite marketing channel. It's very difficult to invest in because it's mostly a product decision thing and positioning rather than sort of a tactic that you invest in after the product's done. But the second big one for us is sources of influence. So we take our own medicine. We go and look at what are the podcasts and websites and YouTube channels and webinars and events and email newsletters and, you know, words and phrases that people are subscribing to and paying attention to in the digital marketing universe. Obviously, because of my background, I have a little bit of extra benefit there, right? And Amanda does too. Amanda's my colleague and our VP of marketing. So we go to these places and we participate and engage with them and whatever, create content with them, do promotions with them. We recently signed one of our first ever paid deal to do this. So we found a guy who's very influential in sort of the world of reaching digital marketers who are exactly our audience. And we did a paid relationship with him where he's going to create a few videos to help promote V2. He's creating some content for our site. We're doing a joint webinar together. We're sponsoring his, I think it's a video and podcast series that he's launching. That's all around topics that we like as well, but it reaches the audience that we want to reach. And so we said, this is a great deal. It's, I think we're spending somewhere in the low tens of thousands of dollars on that. Yeah. But it's experimental, but I think it's interesting. And the third one, the last one, is our email list. So when people come to SparkToro.com, you can sign up for free for a SparkToro account, and then you play with it. It's unlimited free use. So we don't have a free trial where you put in a credit card. That's what I did at Moz. But Casey and I didn't like that structure for SparkToro. And so, several hundred people every week come and try the product for free. And then they get on the email list. And we do a lot of nurture campaigns. Many of them sign up for Amanda's email newsletter that goes out. And
yeah, I'm seeing that.
That turns into a lot of marketing for us as well.
And Amanda, your VP of marketing, Amanda Natividad, she is also building a personal brand. She does a lot of social media content. She creates courses about content marketing. That's interesting as well. So you obviously hire people who are interested in doing that, but also give your staff the space to become, you know, the time to become personal brands, right? Do you believe that's important?
I don't think it's right for every business, but I'm quite passionate about it being right for us. And I think that, you know, we're a very, very weird type of business. Well, SparkToro is three people, myself, Casey, and Amanda. We aim to work French working hours or less, right? So 35 hours a week or less.
Nice.
And very often we have weeks where we can put in 20 hours or less. We are more like European workers than American ones, right? We take probably 30 days of vacation.
Yeah, I was going to say 35 hours a week sounds quite normal. I know what you mean.
yeah, sounds quite normal to you. But let me tell you, when American hosts hear that I, you know, try to aim for 35 hours or less, they're like, how is that possible? How can you possibly build a business? Aren't you afraid that one of your competitors is going to destroy you? And I don't believe that amount of hours worked is the thing that will make our business successful. But I do think things like a lot of freedom and flexibility and giving people the tools to do not just their best work, but to focus on the things that they believe will be the most impactful is super important. So if Amanda told me, you know what, I want to dial back the personal brand thing. I'm not excited about it anymore. I'm really going to focus on whatever the email list and nurturing and, you know, a lot of our campaigns inside SparkToro, a lot of optimization on the site. I would say, great. If that's what you think is best to do, go for it. You know, I'm happy to brainstorm some things that fit into that. And I'm sure Casey will too. But Amanda is very passionate about her personal brand. She's had a lot of success with it even before joining SparkToro.
Yeah.
So why the heck not? You know, I'm thrilled to be able to give Amanda the freedom and flexibility to work on the thing that she wants to work on and also gives benefit to SparkToro. I think because of that freedom and flexibility, because of that trust, you know, we check in with each other almost never, right? We have like a meeting a month. I don't know what Amanda's working on this week. I'm sure it's good. I have no doubt, right?
Yeah.
She'll let me know if she needs
a
help.
A lot of
with
trust
something.
Required there.
Ton of trust required. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Which is great. Interesting. So I can see how that works. I can see how the influence stuff works. The word of mouth. How do you drive that and how do you track it, or can you?
I don't believe that it's trackable without very large scale, expensive market surveys. And we don't have the funds or the motivation. And I don't think we'd have the return on investment to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Word of mouth for us is really about making decisions about sort of two things. One is how we build the product. So the features, the user experience, the design. For example, I think, and I think Casey agrees with me, that currently SparkToro's user experience is extremely easy to use, but it is not beautifully screenshottable. And my suspicion is that if we were to make SparkToro much more beautiful to take a screenshot and put in a presentation and a report and make a sort of report builder that made it very easy for someone to make a gorgeous version of data displays. You know, here's a, whatever, here's a map of the keywords that your audience is searching for on a grid that shows which ones are high affinity with your audience and high opportunity because of their volume. My suspicion is, right, that graphs like that would go into a lot of presentations and reports, that they would go into slideshows that get seen at conferences and events and at webinars. And SparkToro would benefit from that through word of mouth that we would never be able to track. So that's an investment we absolutely want to and should make, but it's really difficult. The second thing is sort of the marketing aspect of word of mouth, and that's how you describe your product and how you create marketing content for it. So that's both, you know, sort of if we were to do advertising, right? How we describe it in our advertising, what do we make it look like, and how we position it. Who do we say SparkToro is for, and what do we say it does for them? My suspicion is, for example, that we could get much narrower if we wanted to. If we were to say, we're going to only make SparkToro for content marketers, and then we were to focus the positioning and the marketing and the descriptions and all the use cases and the videos and the screenshots that we show on that, it would have more word of mouth with content marketers, but we would also lose a little bit of the PR crowd and the educational crowd and that kind of thing.
No, I get that. It's always a compromise between user experience and design. You know, look, the email inbox is not very screenshotable, but it's probably in its most useful form, right? You know, and that's just the way. And SparkToro is very useful, you know, and it's in this kind of plain text. I mean, look at something like Answer the Public. I mean, who actually looks at the radial view and goes like, you know what I mean? It's like everybody instantly clicks list. Do you know? Take the table.
Answer the Public. Yeah, Answer the Public drives me bananas. I worked when I was at Moz. I worked on the keyword research tool there, right? I designed the what was it called? Keyword Explorer, and it became a very successful product. It was actually like a great thing for the company, but whenever we do interviews, tons of people would tell us that they loved Answer the Public. And I could never figure out why. You know, the more I dug in with them, the less sense it made to me because, you know, the user interface is so anti-useful, you know, that radial. And the data is just the same as what you'd get if you went to Google and you searched for a word and then went A, and then searched for the word and went B, and searched for the word and went C, and then you search for the word and you go A, you know, like that's what you get in Answer the Public. I was like, wow, why does this work?
It's just on a plate. It's easy. And I suppose someone, when they were designing it, one of the, you know, developers or designers just showed, wow, look, we can show it radially. And someone was like, oh, that's cool. And then it stuck. But
They clearly knew something I didn't.
Yeah. That is interesting, isn't it? In terms of the way that people get insights from SparkToro, have you noticed certain patterns in behavior of your users? Have you noticed them hunting down very specific things about the audience? Because what I'm leading to here is I'm going to ask you, maybe the next question is going to be, what do you think the most important things, if you had to shortlist them, that we should know about our audience are? But I'm just curious, you know, do you have this like master view of what people are doing? Can you see what people, marketers are hunting down in terms of information in that product?
We can, you know, we obviously have some metrics to see which tabs are most popular and interesting. And occasionally we'll see a spike. Someone will do a YouTube video about, hey, here's how to use SparkToro for figuring out which subreddits your audience pays attention to. This is becoming bigger as, you know, Reddit's become bigger and taken over some of the conversation from Twitter and all that kind of stuff. Reddit's also getting a ton of Google traffic. So there's some people who are like playing with the idea of, hey, maybe I'll just post my stuff to Reddit and then hope it gets upvoted and indexed by Google there, sort of using them as for barnacle SEO, as we used to call it. And that drives some of those spikes. But, you know, historically, the things that were always the most popular were websites that my audience visits, the hidden gem websites, Once we added that hidden gem tab, people love that. The videos, so YouTube channels, that was always a big one. And then demographics. I was quite interested to see that. A lot of people are very interested to know.
But that's really hard to get. That's really hard information to get elsewhere, you know.
I guess so, yeah. It's not hard for us, right? So we just get it from LinkedIn. So LinkedIn has, you know, we have a few hundred million accounts. It's only the public data that we get from LinkedIn, right? So if you were Google and you're crawling LinkedIn, that's all that we can see. But a ton of people, I think something north of 70% of people put their, you know, gender, birthday, all sorts of other stuff in LinkedIn, job title, role description, keywords of skills and interests that they have, et cetera. And then when you get those profiles, right? So we just connect those up to websites, keywords, the clickstream data, and the Google search data. And when we marry those three things, we're able to say, okay, people who search for regenerative agriculture technology are 70% men. Is it perfect? No. Is it probably within plus or minus 5%? Yeah. I'm pretty sure it is.
That's interesting.
That data surprised me. I didn't think marketers really cared that much about, especially those surface level gender and age numbers. Like, that surprised me.
I think it's persona building. I think that probably I would imagine, you know, and again, it's not easy to just grab somewhere. I mean, obviously you can go and get it, but the idea that you can just like hit that tab and go, right, there you go, screenshot that, stick it in your persona or your deck or whatever. Great. I think it's really good for that. Actually, back to but you were marketing, the stuff about marketing SparkToro. I'm curious, why have you not like done a HubSpot, as it were, and just thrown tons of keyword rich article content at the internet to bring in organic search traffic? Because we glazed over that a little bit, because again, that's something you would expect you to do. I mean, curious as to why that's not a priority.
So two big reasons. One, the difficulty of ranking a relatively new domain today compared to 15 years ago is ludicrous. So SparkToro does publish a good amount of content. I've published a lot of big research studies there. In fact, some of them have gone incredibly viral. So I did some research a few years ago about the zero-click search problem in Google, right? That essentially a higher and higher percent of Google searchers don't click on anything because Google solves the searcher's problem for them, this is one of the reasons that I'm not all that big on the AI answers thing. I think Google's already been doing that for forever. Maybe accelerate, but anyway, so I published a bunch of research around this. It was cited in Congress. It got, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of people, maybe north of a million people visiting the blog post alone, shared all over the web. I had a call with Lina Khan, who's now the head of the FTC, you know, appointed by Biden. Like, fascinating stuff, really interesting, went all over the place. SparkToro doesn't rank on page one for Google zero-click searches or zero-click research or any of these things. Because, well, Search Engine Land wrote about the research. They rank for it. Search Engine Journal wrote about the research. A bunch of other blogs that have been around on the internet for 20 years, they wrote about the research. And so we're not going to rank. You know, even if we sort of do perfect on-page SEO, it's going to take us years before we start ranking. I will say, well, once I start seeing SparkToro show up in more rankings, you know, once Google sort of considers us to be more of an authority, which I expect will happen eventually, then I'd be willing to invest more in it. The second reason is, who's going to do all that content?
There's only three of you.
I mean, Casey's not doing it. I don't have time to do it. Amanda focuses on other things. You know, content creation, keyword-rich content creation is not her passion.
No.
So very frankly, we'd have to hire somebody else. I think probably will that eventually happen? Yeah.
Yeah, no, I get that. I mean, what you're talking to there is overall SEO difficulty, aren't you? And the off-page, I'm just putting it into the sort of, you know, terms, but off-page difficulty currently is high because you've got low domain authority. And even with the best content, you're up against those that always rank there on page one. Interesting. That's really interesting.
This is just a personal sort of It sticks in my craw, the kind of content that Google ranks today.
I know.
I really don't like it. I don't find it engaging or interesting. I agree that it is useful to answer short questions that you have, right? Like, whatever. How old is Tom Cruise? It's like, yeah. Boom. There's the article. I want to see, okay, show me the yacht that he was on. Like, all right, it can do that. But, you know, I want to do a deep dive breakdown of why word of mouth marketing has to start at the executive level and the product design level, not after the product has been created. That article is never going to rank for anything. It's probably a really important piece. It's a good topic to talk about. It matters a lot to marketers. If you care about word of mouth marketing, you probably should read it, and Google will never rank it because it's not, well, here's a list of things that, you know, word of mouth marketing entails. And let me give you a quick featured summary about what word of mouth marketing means and where was the term invented. And I don't care. I don't want to create
that content.
That.
It's a shame, isn't it? Yeah, it's the classic problem, isn't it? I just want a recipe for cupcakes and I get the history of cupcakes. You know, 3,000 words later, I might get the recipe. So that is an issue. And maybe that's why more search activity is moving over to social and other places, because we feel like we'll get the answer faster. I think people are getting a little bit jaded with that. Can AI save Google? And... Do you think it can actually make it more useful and cut through that?
Gosh, I think Wall Street mostly believes the inverse, that AI is a big threat to Google. And I can't quite decide for myself. I don't play the stock market at all. I don't I think technically we have some index funds that mean hold some shares. So I can't say I have no Google stock or something. I don't actually know if I have Google stock. I might have Google stock. I'm not sure. But what I can say definitively is I don't play the stock market, and I wouldn't place my money bets on Google winning or losing from AI. I don't think that I think that prediction is like playing the lottery right now. Just unknown.
Yeah, I agree. Go on then. I have to ask you, what do you think will be the impact of AI on marketing, both on jobs, but also just the quality of the marketing?
Let's see. I think it can be very useful and provide a lot of efficiency in certain aspects of marketing. Content creation is a really good one. So for example, you know, I had a project recently where I had to categorize tens of thousands of rows of data. It was you know, human inputted text, not from a survey, but crawled from the web. And I needed to analyze, not exactly sentiment, but categorize each of those into various buckets that they fit into. Historically, I'll tell you what I would have done. I would have paid an intern. I would have been like, hey, go through this. I want you to do 200 of these a day for 2 weeks. And that'll get us through the whatever first 5,000. And then I'll categorize those and we'll see if it applies to the rest of the data set, blah, 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 blah. Now I just plug in the ChatGPT Excel plugin and I say, here's my prompt. Go categorize all these for me. Boom, done. Great. Make my beautiful chart, produce my piece of content. I love it for that. I think it's just fantastic for that. It's great for code reviews, makes programmers a lot more efficient. But it also creates a ton of low quality junk, stuff that nobody wants to read. And unfortunately, a lot of marketers, I don't mean to put you on the spot, Will, right? But when you ask the question, why didn't you do the HubSpot thing and just create a ton of content like you did at Moz, rank for it, earn customers from that? There are a lot of entrepreneurs and marketers who think that way. Well, all I need to do is create 10,000 articles, one about each topic that all these keywords are for. Oh, large language models are good at that. I'll just use them. And let me tell you, friends, that content does two things, right? One, performs on average quite poorly in search engines. And two, does not imbue visitors with unique voice, trust, liking, familiarity, recognizability, all the things that sort of make for great marketing. And I think that stuff is flooding the internet right now. I think it is flooding brands. Okay. I think there's a ton of people who falsely believe that they should be adopting AI and large language models for all sorts of things that they should never be using them for. I think there's probably, as we're recording this, 100 other thought leader influencers in marketing who are telling marketers on some other webinar or recording, if you're not using AI, and I like these 5 AI tools for creating your content, and it's going to generate these things, Google won't know what hit them when you blast them with your large language model content from my new tool. And they're buying it, right? They're buying it and they're biting and they're putting it up on their sites. And
sucks. It's mad. I mean, the phrase I always keep in mind is informational gain. You know, that's what I always tell people. Content has to have informational gain. It has to bring something new, research, opinion, information, whatever. But if it doesn't have that informational gain, it's just regurgitated stuff from elsewhere. You know, Google's algorithm doesn't have to be very advanced to spot that. And that's, I would imagine, part of a lot of people's job in the Google search team is just keeping out that torrent of stuff, because Google is the librarian of the internet. And, you know, it used to be dealing with just the odd person turning up saying, can I put my book in the library? And now there's like hordes of people trying to like crowd the library. Like, no, what's going on? So, but without that informational gain, you're right. What does it say about your brand? Do you want people coming to your website and seeing that?
I mean, yeah. To be honest, what it reminds me of is how email spammers use low quality, poorly spelled, really sketchy messaging to essentially filter out their targets, right? They filter for the most gullible targets who are going to believe whatever junk is being fed to them. And so the fact that they had to send 100,000 emails to find, you know, one poor old lady in Wichita who fell for the scam is fine with them. And I think of large language model content very much the same, right? It's just not, it can never be novel, because the only way it generates text is based on the index of text that it already has. So it cannot give you new novel approaches, or if it does, they cannot also be accurate, right? If you ask ChatGPT to give you some new research on a topic, it will imagine crap for you, but you know, it has no basis in reality.
Yeah, true. And again, that's probably not great for the brand.
Also, have you ever tried? Have you ever tried asking it to be funny?
Yeah, I've asked it loads of things like that, but it's not very funny.
It is. You know, when the kids talk about cringe humor these days, I just anytime I look at ChatGPT, I just see a complete lack of humor and very much a lack of humanity. Right, the way that you interface with another person and connect with them and have that, it has that robotic CEO who's been invited on CNBC, which is a television news station where people talk about boring business crap here in the United States. Not to crap on them, Fox Business is no better, right? Like, well, pick your. I'm sure the, you know, other than that one famous video of the kid going into the guy's room, the BBC's you know, services is no better. But it reminds me of that, right? You've been PR coached to not say anything interesting, by which you're also not saying anything brand damaging. And that's kind of what I get from ChatGPT.
Well, it's true, isn't it? And I'm not, you know, I'm not trying too hard to bring this round to be like an advert for SparkToro or anything, but that is the whole point about persona building and understanding the audience, is so that the more, you know, the more fine and granular that fingerprint is, the more perfect you can create this content that maximally resonates with them. And that can never be generic. It's the opposite of generic.
Yes. Very well said, Will. And I will say this about SparkToro. You can't just do this in SparkToro. SparkToro will not tell you how to have a brand voice and how to talk to your customers and how to create content that's engaging and that builds trust and value, it will only tell you the specific things, right? So once you've created that content, if you can get this person on social to share it and this person to feature it on their webinar and this person to talk about it on their website, yes, that is likely to reach your audience. But that content generation, that marketing and positioning process, that brand strategy and thoughtfulness, that has to come from a human being. That has to come from a human being who cares about what other people think of them and their product and can empathize and put themselves in the shoes of their customers. That hasn't changed in hundreds of years, right? Like the thing that makes you great at customer empathy is also going to make you great at brand marketing and positioning and content strategy. And no tool can replace that.
True. Yeah, it's very true that you seem to have a real passion for this stuff. How do you stay three things: productive, creative, but also happy at the same time? What's your secret?
Okay. First off, I do want to dismiss the myth that I am always happy. I do love talking about this stuff. I love engaging with people. I love teaching them, but I have historically struggled with depression and anxiety. I wrote about it in Lost and Founder. I've written about it on the blog. And so I have as much empathy as anyone for folks who are struggling through that. I recognize it's hard. I have tough days myself. I really do. But I will say that a few things have helped me tremendously, and they hit on all three of those. So productivity, creativity, and happiness. And that is doing work that I don't always enjoy, but always believe serves a purpose. I think one of my biggest frustrations, Will, one of the hardest things for me, absolutely, my last few years at Moz, after I stepped down as CEO, was doing things that I was sort of told to do or asked to do inside the company, but I didn't believe that they added value. That it was such a struggle for me. I remember a conversation with my CEO. We had a lot of fraught conversations, this one in particular. And, you know, she said, I can't get you to do, work that you don't want to do. And I replied, I don't think that's fair. I am happy to do work that I don't enjoy if I believe that it has a positive outcome. That is something that's really sacred and important to me in all my companies now and in my personal life. I think this is one of the reasons I have to be CEO is because I get to control those things.
Well, it's true, isn't it? I mean, like if you look at literal, not metaphorical, but literal mountain climbers, you know, it's awful. I mean, it sounds like hell, awful. But because you know that there's this bigger aim, this bigger goal, you don't mind, right? You don't mind the momentary kind of suffering. Okay.
That's interesting. The joy of being able to, it's a silly thing, right? But like when the other network picked up that Netflix show that got canceled, I don't know if SparkToro's data was the instrumental thing. I'm sure there was a big calculation, but you know, when they came back to me and told me that happened, I just cheered. I thought to myself, oh my God, look at what we've done. You know, this is so great. This is going to help so many people solve their problems and for a really affordable price. That got me excited. Mm-hmm. The second piece that I would say in there is I have to get a lot of sleep. If I work myself to the bone. So, you know, the 35 hours thing, this is across both the companies that I run, by the way, right? So Snack Bar and SparkToro for me, I can't have them taking up, you know, all my time and monopolizing that. I have a lot of other personal interests and obligations and, family and friends stuff that I do. I try to get regular daily walks, right? Get my 10,000 steps and all those kinds of things. And that, you know, that feeds into it. Like I have to be healthy in order to be happy, and I have to be happy and healthy to be creative and productive.
Yeah.
I bet a ton of your listeners and viewers will resonate with this. There are days when I get up and I haven't had a great night's sleep and I'm stressed out, and just getting through the first 30 or 40 messages in my inbox is like a 5-hour process. It takes me forever. you know, I sit at the screen, I stare at this email. Okay, I don't know what I want to say here. And other days, including days when I'm on vacation, I'll get up, I'll look at my inbox, I'm well-rested, I'm relaxed, everything's going great, I don't have any calls or anything like that. And I will get through those same 40, 50 emails in 60 minutes or less. The whole day, you know, the whole day's work is done in an hour or less. And the difference is not the, you know, it's not the person, I'm the same person. It's just that when you are well-rested and happy and relaxed and you've had all these things going for you, you're productive. Like you can breeze through work. If you've ever come back from vacation and been like, wow, I can't believe I caught up on everything over 2 weeks in a day.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. You got to be kind to yourself and give yourself that time to relax, recharge, and live a life for sure. And one last question for you, like, why this? What did you want to be when you were kind of like 10 years old?
I don't know whether this is embarrassing or predictable, but my parents like to tell the story of where when I was a very young kid. I think I must have been younger than 10, maybe 6 or 7. And I was asked, maybe by a friend of theirs or something, oh, what do you want to be when you grow up? Or asked at school. And I said, I want to be a dog. Because everybody loves dogs and people are always sweet to dogs and they pet them and take care of them. Nobody gets mad at dogs. That was my...
How were you going to do that then? What was the... you didn't plan just...
You know...
the it, mind of a child.
Yeah, right. To me, it seemed just as reasonable as firefighter or mountain climber or, you know, that. Marketing entrepreneur.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, when I was 6, I insisted I was going to marry our family dog, Sally. I was 6. I just thought this is who I want to spend the rest of my life with, you know, and that's what he's supposed to marry. And she, yeah. You know,
this goes to, I mean, I think the joint point we're making here is that dogs are great and people love
dogs
them.
Dogs are great.
Dogs are great.
And, yeah, never take life aspirations seriously from a 6-year-old.
I mean, my suspicion is, I don't know about the UK, but I believe marrying your dog in the United States would be against the law.
I don't think it's okay.
And we let people do anything over here. Like you can get away
with
all
of it. By the way, I didn't, just so you know, it didn't happen.
Yeah. Dear listener, don't worry, Will. No, Will engages in human romance, not...
Yeah, I married a human in the end, but some similarities with Sally, the family dog, in a sort of way. And nice ones, you know. She's very, very sympathetic, very... Yeah.
Anyway. Should I hand you the shovel cool. So you can keep digging? Or do you wanna...
Yeah. I don't think she watches this podcast anymore. She's sick of the sound of my voice, so... well, look, Rand, I really appreciate your time that you've given us. It's been fascinating. I could talk to you all night about this stuff. There's loads of stuff I'd love to talk to you about we didn't have time for. But
well, hopefully I will be back on the show in the future. But yes, it was lovely. Thank you.
We'd love to do that. Yeah, thanks a lot. Of course, one last thing to ask you. Where can people find and connect with you online?
Yeah, so I put my email address out there publicly. I'm rand@sparktoro.com. If you cool. want to try SparkToro for free, like I said, you can go to sparktoro.com. It's right out there on the homepage, no credit card required. And if you want to check out the video game, you can put your email into snackbarstudio.com and we'll send you an email when the video game launches.
If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about transforming your marketing career through certified online training, head to digitalmarketinginstitute.com. Thanks for listening.